Welcome to this week's anime podcast. This week, the usual crew are not here. It's myself, Alex, with a special guest, Brian Hanley, Dr. Brian Hanley, who is an expert in our particular group, the group we're going to be talking about today, the last of our rogues gallery of paramilitary, terrorist, rebel groups, whatever you want to call them. That's been the whole subject of this season, trying to figure out what to call groups like the Provisional IRA, which is our kind of first, or probably our last group to be discussed. Dr. Hanley is currently working at Trinity, I believe, aren't you? Or are you still? Yep, you are. That's a hot nod of the head. I won't say any more because I don't want to get him fired. he's done us a great service by coming to talk to us about this. Now, we might begin with a basic and very basic history, and a short one, of where the Irish Republican Army as a group came from. And again, for anyone who's Irish, and most of our listeners are Irish, you might say to yourself, well, that's going to take an entire series. We'll try and keep it basic. For those of you living in Britain, we do have listeners in Britain and the US. Feel free to look in the footnotes of this podcast. You'll find more information on this. So, Brian, would you like to just give us a very basic history of where the group came from? Well, its origins, anyway.
The modern IRA, on the one hand, would have always traced its history right back to a tradition of resistance to British rule, going back to the 1790s and so on. But realistically, every organization that calls itself the IRA has its origins in the Irish Revolutionary period, of broadly from 1912 onwards, when you have the crisis brought about by the firstly the resistance of unionists to the idea of self-government for Ireland, the foundation of the Ulster Volunteers, a response to that by nationalists and the formation of the Irish Volunteers, called themselves Óglach na hÉireann, founded in 1913. The IRA also describes itself as Óglach na hÉireann, as the Army of Ireland. And within that very broad body of volunteers, you had a diverse group of people, but you had an organization called the Irish Republican Brotherhood, a revolutionary organization which dated back to the 1860s, which joined the Irish Volunteers and encouraged the establishment of the Irish Volunteers with the idea that this could be the nucleus of a revolutionary force. Now, ultimately, the outbreak of the Great War changes everything. But in 1916, a section of the Irish Volunteers, just a section, takes part in a rebellion in Dublin, along with a small socialist militia called the Irish Citizens Army and a number of other small auxiliary bodies, Cumann na mBan, which is the women's auxiliary of the Volunteers, and so on. And during that rebellion, the term Irish Republican Army or Army of the Irish Republic is used, and there's a proclamation of an Irish Republic. And very crudely, many people would argue that's the origins of the modern IRA. Now, right up to 1920, 1921, people still refer to the Irish Volunteers a lot of the time, but the term IRA does come into more general usage during the struggle for independence. And again, the date 1919 is usually used as the beginning of what's called the War of Independence. Certainly by 1921, you have the IRA as the organization which sees itself as the Army of the Irish Republic. It's waging war on behalf of an elected Irish underground administration, Dáil Éireann, and which then enters into a truce with the British government in July 1921. And out of that truce, there's ultimately negotiations, an Anglo-Irish treaty, and a split. Now, we're at the centenary of all this at the moment, so people in Ireland will be hearing lots about it, but the civil war, which takes place over the signing of the Anglo-Irish Treaty and all the rest of it, gives birth again to the anti-treaty IRA. And again, every variation thereof in the present day dates from the anti-treatyites, those who see themselves as defending the Republic of 1916, as refusing to compromise with this settlement imposed by Britain as they see it in 1921 to 1922. Now, I would argue that the contexts are often very different in each generation. You have different types of people involved, different tactics used, but all the organizations who call themselves the IRA, from the Provisionals to everybody else, see themselves as those who rejected that compromise in 1921, who rejected the treaty.
Yeah, and it should be said that I think it was March, you probably correct me here, March of 22, that the Army Council met in Dublin, and basically, this is before the Civil War for those listening, basically said, you know, those who had signed the treaty were effectively traitors, they're not to be trusted, we're the real government of Ireland. And that was still the view of the IRA even in the late 60s, when kind of the modern provisional IRA came into being. The view was that almost as it's like a chalice of ambrosia. It's like there's the special revolutionary juice, the Republican juice, only we can administer that. We're kind of like almost like a Catholic Church. The only we can give you the Eucharist of proper republicanism. And that would remain for I think even longer than the late 60s. That was still the view, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think it's a bit more complicated than that, because the you know, even those of us who are kind of well-versed have probably underestimated the extent to which the anti-treaty IRA was really divided. It was never one unified army at all. And in March 1922, as you say, they meet in Dublin and they reject the settlement and they reject the new provisional government and so on. But they're not united. I mean, the people who take over the four courts, and again, Irish listeners might be familiar with all this, you know, the group that take over the four courts and are eventually attacked there, don't represent the majority of the anti-treaty IRA at all. The majority of the anti-treaty IRA is very, very cautious, doesn't really want to go to war over this, wants to find some kind of way out of it, maybe renew the war with Britain, but not fight their former comrades. So I think the rhetoric of Republican legitimacy that's often dragged out at the time of splits, and also then as a kind of a justification when you run out of other reasons why you're doing what you're doing, means a lot less to a lot of the people involved than the kind of practicality. So I think that the anti-treaty IRA are ultimately defeated in the Civil War, but they're still a quite significant force in Ireland. But a large chunk of their leadership become the new Fianna Fáil party after 1926. And the IRA itself then kind of eschews political leadership. It doesn't really believe in all this legitimate stuff. It embarks on a journey towards the left and so on. It is notable 1939, when a guy called Sean Russell becomes chief of staff, that he goes back and says, actually, the legitimacy lies in the second Dáil. We've got, you know, seven members of that still support us. So they are the actual government and they're now giving us governmental powers. Now, he only does that because he wants some kind of political legitimacy for launching a campaign against Britain. And yes, there are people who take it absolutely seriously and people die over these things, so I'm not going to ridicule it. But really, for the majority of Republicans, that's not the reason why they do what they do. And I think those who still believe in it should actually look at the politics of those TDs that had stuck with the second Dáil and really think about whether they'd want to be associated with the politics of any of them, because they weren't by any means the most progressive or forward thinking of that generation of people elected in 1921, 1922. And then it's held up as kind of a reason, you know, that the Free State is illegitimate. Northern Ireland's obviously illegitimate. We have the real Republican ethos here. But in real terms, you know, more basic reasons, I think, motivate a lot of people. And a more basic politics, which is we believe in a United Irish Republic. That doesn't exist. We've got to fight for one. And what I should stress is that for the IRA, in what becomes the Free State, the 26 counties, the Civil War looms large for decades. It really shapes them. But for the IRA in the North, they're in a very different situation. They're still part of the United Kingdom. Their experiences of pogroms, of discrimination, sectarianism, and their experience is quite different. So they really, and it's obviously the modern provisional IRA really emerges in the North in the late 60s and early 70s. Their story is a little bit different. And that's why I think when people look at the IRA today, the cliche is a northern accent. Everybody sees republicanism as coming from the north. Historically, it didn't. Historically, you know, in the 20th century at least, the south was far more important. The IRA was far bigger in the south. The IRA had far more influence in what becomes the 26 counties. But from the late 60s onwards, that dynamic shifts. And that gives it a particular coloration as well. And even little terms that we use about the IRA, they all come from the modern era. There was no RA in 1920. That comes from the north. That comes from the 1970s. Nobody in 1920 talked about getting the Brits out. That, again, comes from the modern era. Chucky our law. That's a modern slogan, you know, our day will come. That all comes from the north.
It should be said, just as a little joke, there's a reason why Sean Russell's statue in Fairview always gets his head chopped off every occasion. Not a very nice man, if you look into his history, but that's for someone else to follow up on. Important part is why what we consider to be the modern IRA reemerges in the mid to late 1960s in Northern Ireland. Now, for most people, they already know this because most of our viewers are Irish. Best way to describe Northern Ireland would be an orange state. I would think it's fair enough to say that by mid-60s. It was very much a state where a form of light Jim Crow existed. Issues of gerrymandering in local councils, difficulty finding work, difficulty finding housing. Police were, I think, 90% Protestant. The B specials was a paramilitary wing that existed for a very long time. And certainly the power of Stormont was almost a power of an Anglo-Irish, almost aristocracy. If you look at the Brookborough, the Craigs and the Brookboroughs and the Chichester Clarks and the Terence's O'Neills, if you actually listen to them talk, it's very much almost an aristocratic English accent you can hear from them. And one of the interesting things is you have almost an insurrection growing within the North, within almost like in quotation marks Ulster Scots, and I use that very lightly. It's not meant to be anything more than a very basic idea of what that means, which is Presbyterian Antrim kind of Ian Paisley. And I suppose the things that's interesting about what happened to the original IRA, what begins to happen in the mid-60s, is before there is a nationalist kind of response, there is a unionist kind of, I don't want to use the word offensive, but certainly increased aggression. And so what we now know is that people like Ian Paisley, people like in a re-emerging Ulster Volunteer Force, we have three Catholics killed in Belfast in 1966. This is the same year you have the 50-year anniversary of the 1916 Rising in Dublin. There's certainly also deindustrialization, the loss of the empire. There's a lot going on in the UK. Our Northern Ireland isn't a bubble, doesn't exist in a vacuum. There's things that are coming in from the outside. But why do you think that, it's a big question, so again, don't go on forever about it, because there's several books in this subject, but why do you think the IRA, what became the Provisional IRA, had the oxygen to kind of burst into life in the late 60s?
Yeah, well, it's the backlash against increasing demands for civil rights by nationalists in the 60s that produces ultimately sectarian conflagration in the summer of 1969, and therefore a desire by nationalists for defence, and also then ultimately a desire to hit back. Important to say again that Northern Ireland was created on the basis that nationalists would be a minority, and they would be a minority that could be controlled by the unionist majority. So, you know, it was crudely 60-40 or so on in terms of its composition. But even within that, of course, you've got areas that are majority nationalist or areas that are 50-50. So the unionist government was always really aware of what they saw as the threat. Now, again, don't want to go on too much, but 1969, 1970 is only 50 years since the creation of Northern Ireland. There were people around who could remember how bad things were in 1921, 1922. And an older generation of nationalists were very aware, especially in Belfast and elsewhere, of their vulnerability to unionists if things got bad. But by the 60s, you had a younger generation, some of them more educated. Again, there's a lot of cliches about that whole generation, but things were changing. Northern Ireland was a discriminatory state, but it was part of the United Kingdom, and it was part of Western Europe. And people did have the vote, and they did have televisions, and they could travel. So, of course, it wasn't sealed off. It couldn't be controlled in the way that a totalitarian state, for example, could be. So you've got demands for change. And ultimately, some of the Republican movement, coming off the back of a failed small-scale armed campaign between 56 and 62, the so-called border campaign, they argue that the Republican movement has to become involved on the ground in all these campaigns, north and south. And they're particularly interested in civil rights, as are a wide variety of other people. And by 1968, 1969, increasingly their civil rights marches and protests, which are often banned, which are often dispersed violently by the police. But on the other side, then you've got a growing chunk of the unionist population led by people like Ian Paisley, who believe that their leadership are going to sell out, who believe that the British can't be trusted, which is another feature of radical unionism, and who therefore argue that they should be hitting back. So they're attacking civil rights marchers and they're mobilizing as well. As you said, in 1966, loyalist paramilitaries had already killed people. So by the summer of 1969, things are becoming more violent and these things explode in Derry and in Belfast. The IRA is involved on the ground. The IRA in Belfast does defend nationalist areas, but the IRA is very ill-equipped and underarmed and is taken by surprise. And a lot of ordinary nationalists, but particularly maybe some older Republicans as well, argue that this wasn't good enough, that the IRA's primary duty should have been to defend nationalist communities and that something should be done about it. Now, there is another 10 podcasts in that debate, but certainly that is a factor in a demand in Belfast initially, and each area of the North as well is quite distinctive and quite different in terms of its makeup, even within the Republican movement, for a militant response in case events like this occur again. And by this stage, the British government have intervened directly and the British Army has come into the equation too.
As you said, there's 10 podcasts really in the whole origin of that. And so, again, I'll provide some links for people who want to learn more about each era, really, of this whole story. But broadly speaking, by 69, 70, the IRA, the old IRA, which itself was just another iteration of the IRA, again, depending on when you want to start the story, they had serious internal issues. Broadly speaking, the South was still dominant, as you said, kind of the Civil War era people and people from the 30s, so Cathal Goulding and a few other names I can't remember, wanted to take the movement more along a socialist line, one whereby they felt they could unite the workers of the North with the South, and that would be the main, basically the James Connolly tactic, which goes back to the strikes and kind of cooperation in Belfast, I think 50, 60 years before. Now, that's their view, and their view is that most we should be defending communities, but certainly not attacking our unionist neighbors. There are sections, as you said, there's about, I think, something in the region of 1,500 families are burned out of parts of Belfast. And most, 80% of them are Catholic homes that are burned out. And there's very much a feeling is the IRA is meant to be defending us, and it's not. And a group led by Joe Cahill is his name, I believe. Dahi O'Connell, Sean McStephon, it's easier to remember his name, Rory O'Brody, and many others meet and say, well, basically, this is time for us to effectively, the word split you can use, but really just take hold of the movement. It's not so much a split as it's a kind of a coup d'etat, taking over the Army Council and the Chief of Staff. Again, you can correct me if I'm wrong about this. And their attitude is we need to have a plan whereby we first organize, second, defend and retaliate, and third, to quote Sean McStephon, escalate. Basically, draw in the British Army and make this, take this from what it was, which again, you can correct me here, a civil war, which I think it's fair to call it a civil war, into something which was much more of a colonial struggle, one that they were more familiar with from the 1920s and the 19-teens. And that's kind of the split between the two factions. You've written a book with a lovely journalist on the officials. We're not going to so much talk about them. But why is it, do you think, that the provisionals became dominant by 1972?
Yeah, there's a lot there again. We've got to condense things. I mean, I think there's a number of elements that kind of give rise to the provisionals. There is in Belfast an older generation, people like Billy McKee and Joe Cahill and so on, who'd either dropped out or left post the border campaign. There are people in the South who are uneasy with the direction of the movement, particularly over the idea that they might enter parliamentary politics and in some way then recognize the legitimacy of the North and South. And again, refusing to recognize the 26 county state is a major thing for people like Rory O'Brody and Sean McStephon. There's a suspicion, they would argue, that the movement is becoming less serious about the need to fight for a united Ireland. People like Cathal Goulding and Sean Garland and Seamus Costello and others on the official side would have denied that. They would have said, of course, there is still going to be an armed struggle at some point. the lesson they drew from the failure of previous campaigns was that you couldn't have a campaign unless you had mass political support, and you had to win that in various ways. And they're quite, they underestimate really the potential there is for an armed campaign, and whereas the provisionals seem to realize that actually, yes, you can have an armed campaign in a small place as the north of Ireland in the 1970s. And they proved that really. And I suppose the context for this, the armed struggle wouldn't have developed the way it did. I mean, I think there's a big argument today, and particularly because one of the major cultural divides in modern Ireland is your attitude to what happened in the north from 1969 to the late 1990s, and whether the IRA's campaign had any legitimacy. And what Republicans always say is, we didn't want war, war came to us. And there's a grain of truth in that I think the British state and the Unionists created the conditions for war. Between 1970 and 1972, a whole series of things happened which made full-scale war more likely. But at the same time, the leadership of the IRA, and particularly the people who formed the provisionals, wanted a war. I mean, they believed that you could only achieve a united Ireland by force of arms. So the idea that, you know, the British forced them to fight, I think is incorrect. But whether that campaign would have gained any kind of impetus is another question, without a whole series of other things. And that included the Falls Road curfew, you know, when the British Army imposed a curfew on the Falls area of Belfast. Four civilians were killed during that. The British Army in the early 70s kills civilians, you know, with impunity. No soldiers are prosecuted for any of that. We're only going through now, you know, things like inquiries into the Ballymurphy massacre, Bloody Sunday, and so on. So again, to condense things, the British state backs up the Unionists. The British Army behaves, even though it's in the United Kingdom, they behave as if they're in Aden or Kenya and so on. And they themselves take a long time to work out exactly what type of strategy you should employ in this kind of situation. But it means that they kill civilians, they lie about it. The nationalist community, particularly in urban areas, begins to radicalize, to demand, you know, to hit back. Internment without trial is introduced in August 1971, used exclusively against nationalists. And the provisionals, I think, have a very simple solution, which is destroy the state, you know, get rid of Stormont, which is the place of Unionist government, and then force the British out. And everybody can understand that. You know, the officials ultimately, who at the same time are also taking part in armed actions, while believing that really in the long run you need all these other kind of political campaigns, in many ways, even though they still have quite a substantial amount of support, the provisionals have a much clearer answer, really. And they're working off a template, which is that in 1921, the IRA had forced the British to the negotiating table and for some reason didn't carry it through. Now, that's a whole other day's work, because Republicans never really tend to delve into why that didn't work out. But ultimately, we'll do the same thing. And in the summer of 1972, they are at the negotiating table with the British government. So it seems to be working. So I think the provisional has become the dominant force, because they do seem to be winning to some extent. Now, outside of that, you've got a big, big section of the nationalist community who are never supporters of the armed struggle. But that, again, is another story. Certainly lots of them are for a period in 1971, 1972.
Yeah, I mean, it should be said, though, it's not, as Michael D. Higgins said a couple of years ago in regards 1916, he says, just because, you know, a group isn't running for the local council doesn't necessarily mean it doesn't have support. He was defending the 1916 rising as an event. But that said, looking at the voting patterns, it's not until the early 2000s that Sinn Féin overtakes the SDLP as the dominant kind of electoral party in the nationalist community. So it would be wrong to say that everything the IRA did was agreed with or supported by the people that might have given them the back room to sleep in or given them some money in the local pub. The nature, I think, of these types of conflicts are, if you're faced with a aggressive state, and obviously by Bloody Sunday in January of 1972, it's pretty clear that individuals, though obviously they wouldn't have known his name at the time, people like Frank Kitson and the FRU, the Force Research Unit, and many, basically the whole plethora of MI5, SAS, all these types of groups which were present in Northern Ireland, supporting, funding, passing on intelligence to the UD, what became the UDA, what became, you know, the UVF that was already in existence, all, you know, to target and kill civilians who happen to be related, sometimes very tenuously related, to members of the Republican movement, not even necessarily members of the IRA. I'm thinking of the McKearneys in Tyrone. There's a lot going on, and to pretend that as many people do, that the IRA is somehow existing in a vacuum where they're these evil Dracula characters descending on Northern Ireland, which was some peaceful utopia, is bullshit. And anyone who says that is either deliberately making an argument in the bad faith, or is very ignorant and shouldn't be making statements about such a complicated, you know, multi-layered conflict. But I'm getting off topic. So we have the existence of Provisional IRA, which by 1972 numbers, and again, these are mostly figures based on British intelligence, by about, there would have been about 1,200 or so active individuals by 1972. By this time, you have starting to make connections to people like Gaddafi, Muammar Gaddafi, the Palestinian Liberation Organization. Irish-American funding was beginning to come in very large number. There was, as one person said after Bloody Sunday, there was an unlimited supply of young men who were willing to join the IRA because they wanted to hit back for what was happening. So there's a lot going on. But the question I have for you is a key one, which, because I think apart from the dynamite campaign of the late 19th century, which was very explicitly destroy buildings, make a mark in London. Apart from that one case, there has always been a resistance to employ bombings by Republicans in the past, previously. Now, it doesn't say that didn't happen, but obviously in the 30s and early 40s, there was a campaign by the IRA as well. But it was very badly received. It was never really considered a good tactic to gain public support. And yet the IRA will primarily be known for its use of car bombs, bombings to destroy civilian infrastructure, to basically cost the British state enormous amounts of money, to tie down troops to protect certain buildings. Later on, much later on, that will be, and thankfully only briefly, a form of suicide bombing will be employed, where I think it was Patsy Gillespie was handcuffed to his steering wheel and a bomb of Semtex placed in the back of his van and driven at a border building. So, I mean, thankfully that was brief and they didn't go any further, though interestingly defended at the time by Martin McGuinness. The point is, what do you think the tactics they employ says about the struggle they were fighting, about their attitude to it? There's an awful lot to go on here. Obviously, there's Enniskillen, Birmingham, Guildford. We could go on about how the kneecappings were employed against drug dealers and against members of the movement that they see had crossed the line. There were some sectarian murders as well, though it seems that it wasn't really policy to kill Protestant people, but so much as retaliation for UD. There's a lot there, obviously, but what do you think the tactics they employ say about them? Do you think they are defensible?
I think there's you know, a case to be made that people, again, have to really go back and look at the different contexts and circumstances in the way that the armed struggle develops, because it changes over time. And really what you have in 1971-72 is almost an insurrection in certain areas, particularly urban areas of Nationalist Belfast and Derry and so on, where the IRA is able to operate openly, where it more or less engages the British Army in open warfare. Over 200 British soldiers, certainly over 100 British soldiers are killed in 1972. A lot of that happens in gun battles and so on. And it is, you know, the case that a lot of people south of the border view that as, in many ways, you know, legitimate to some extent, that this is a war that we can recognize in terms of the way the IRA is supposed to behave. That's a whole other question. But nevertheless, there are certain actions that I think right throughout the period, people argue have a justification. And even in the 1980s, people would have said, if the IRA stuck to killing British soldiers, maybe they'd be okay. Now, that might be a very impractical or very naive way of looking at it, but nevertheless, you'd have often heard that view expressed. The point was, however, that from a very early stage, firstly, through necessity, through the IRA is very poorly armed to begin with, and it becomes better armed, and ironically, by the end, is far better armed than any IRA in history. But at the same time, isn't able to really utilize that realizes quickly that obviously explosives can be made relatively cheaply and can be very effective. So you know, in 1970, you have booby trap bombs. You have the beginnings of a bombing campaign. That really escalates during 1971. And again, part of the idea is most of the business, most of the structure of society is owned by the British or by the Unionists. British Army are wrecking homes in nationalist areas. One way you retaliate is to attack, you know, symbols of Unionist authority, symbols of the government, you know, things ranging from income tax offices to electricity substations to things like that. But also then you obviously attack military installations if you can. But then you also realize that in order to cause disruption, to tie down the British military. And the idea is really, and I think it's again, how much it's really thought out initially and how much of it is retrospective thinking is the idea, oh, you could bankrupt the British in Ireland. You could make it too costly for them to hold on by commercial bombing, simply by carrying out bomb attacks against businesses and town centres and so on. And eventually the car bomb becomes the main way of doing that. And that happens in the spring of 1972. Republican News talks about how the war is being won and it's basically, you know, eulogizes the car bomb as a method. Now, the problem is, firstly, an enormous amount of young IRA recruits have very rudimentary skills. Most armies find that if they don't train their volunteers adequately, that they kill each other. That happens in regular armies. It happens a lot in the IRA as well. So there's a series of disasters where civilians and IRA volunteers are killed in premature explosions, where there are meant to be warnings, but there aren't, or where warnings are misheard. The IRA at the time would say the British are deliberately doing this in order to make the IRA look bad. I think most people admit today that a lot of the time it's absolutely bungled, that there is, you know, that all the problems that you can imagine occur when people are trying to use phone boxes to phone in a warning quickly and so on. And that has a catastrophic effect on society. There is no point pretending that if you are injured in a bomb attack, or if your life is changed by it, or if a relative is killed or a friend, that it is not going to define your view for the next 20, 30 years. So, of course, it deepens division. It leads to, you know, over 100 civilian deaths, I think thousands of injuries, a lot of IRA volunteers killed as well. And I think it costs them popular opinion in the South. The South begins to recoil, and it begins to recoil because it feels that this can't be justified. Now, that again might be naive, or it might be, you know, a way of saying, well, you know, I don't want to be part of this, and I don't have to live there anyway. But nevertheless, it is real. And despite that, the IRA does become more professionalized and more streamlined, but it never gives up on this tactic of bombing because it's hugely effective in terms of causing destruction, making the world realize, you know, the idea is the British can never claim that there's a normal society here when every week Belfast city centre has to be cleared or Derry city centre has to be cleared, or that, you know, bombs are continually going off in all kinds of places. So it's a tactic that's always used, and it's obviously used in Britain as well and is seen as hugely effective. But it comes with costs. With the best will in the world, it's almost impossible not to do that without causing civilian injuries or deaths. And that's a factor right throughout. And I think from a purely practical political point of view, it cost them an enormous amount of passive support, at least, that they wouldn't have cost them otherwise. But nevertheless, it comes to define them in many ways in terms of their. But there's a whole, you know, you mentioned a whole range of other things. The IRA's campaign changes over time, and tactics, targets change. Sometimes certain things are justified, and other times they're not. The British also then set in place a series of constraints on the IRA, and the IRA's own base places constraints on it as well. There's things that people won't tolerate. For example, if you're doing a series, you know, and you're looking at other places, some of the tactics used by Palestinian groups in the 1970s were never employed by the IRA. Similarly, some of the tactics used by the small organizations that existed in Europe are not employed by the IRA either. So there is a communal, the IRA does have a degree of popular support, and that also constrains you to an extent.
Yeah, it should be said that I've mentioned it before, but much like with groups like the PKK and groups like the EZLN, which are broadly linked to an ethnic group, I use that very lightly because there are many ethnic groups in Mexico And the term Amerindian or indigenous person can mean many different groups that live in the Chiapas. But either way, the Isialen, the Zapatistas, have been able to identify themselves with that group, and they protected them. And the reason why they still exist is that same reason. The PKK is the same. It's linked to the Kurds, the cause of Kurdish liberation. They survive in very, very, as you know, very difficult circumstances. They would not survive. They would not be able to do half the things they're doing today if they didn't have that link. And the IRA had that advantage, with some asterisks next to that. Now, so we fast forward a bit to the mid-70s. Ish. And we have a number of things to talk about here. There's one that they refer to themselves as socialist. Now, this is a canard with most actual lefties, like myself, because many people would say, well, actually, the officials talked and walked the walk in regards to what they actually believed. The main question would be there, are they, you know, they're calling themselves socialists. They have new platforms called Era Nua, where they're saying we need parliaments for each province. They're talking, this is our year of victory. So if you're an IRA volunteer and it's the early to mid 70s, your belief is, okay, well, we're getting somewhere here. We have a plan for what's going to happen. People like Sean McStephon, Gerry Adams, Martin McGuinness, young men, head over to meet with the British, I think it's 72. But there's another meeting and a ceasefire in 74. And so your belief is that this is going somewhere. Do you think they actually ever were at that time, or maybe at any time, close to achieving even half of their, you know, some of their big goals? Do you think that the British would ever have countenance withdrawing, which is what the IRA wanted them to do? Because there is evidence in terms of letters from members of the British Army to the government. They certainly, the British make no bones about the fact that if they could get out, they would. That seems to be, and that's always been the case probably. But do you think they ever were at any point even marginally close to achieving some of their goals?
Yeah, I mean, I think they were, in the sense that I think the British would have got out at various points, but there are also constraints on the British side. I mean, this is, again, ironically, the IRA of 1921 was fighting against the most powerful empire in the world at the time and managed to achieve a degree of success, whereas the United Kingdom in the 1970s was in free fall and the British Empire was gone and in decline. But ironically, I think that made compromise more difficult for the British state in some ways. To concede defeat in a part of the United Kingdom, I think, would have been very difficult. On the other hand, they had no emotional attachment, you know, to the Unionists or to even the Union. They were prepared to talk to the IRA from a very early stage, and they talked to them in 1972. Very dramatically. And I think that made the IRA leadership think they were very close to success. Now, the political theory and the various ideas of the IRA leadership, again, are very diverse at the time. And I think on the ground, volunteers north and south and elsewhere believe a whole range of things. But ultimately, they are fighting to get the British out as quickly as possible. And again, I suppose people should read books like Patrick McGee's Where Grieving Begins, or Brendan Hughes' Up Like a Bird, to get two very different views, Tommy McKierney's book From Insurrection to Parliament, to get very different views of activists involved on the ground, because they are very different. And they look at things, you know, depending on where you were from, the experiences can be quite different. And an IRA volunteer active on the ground has a completely different range of experiences to somebody like Sean McStephon or Rory O'Brady, or even somebody like Joe Cahill, for example, who are in the leadership. And then ultimately, I think they still think up to the mid-1970s that things can be escalated to the point that the British will think about some kind of withdrawal. They talk about Euro victory and they talk about Brits out now, but there is a less absolutist range of options. You know, they talk about the British declaring intent to withdraw within, say, a five-year period, releasing all prisoners, withdrawing troops to barracks and so on, which is not quite the dramatic to just pack up and leave the next day. And people like O'Brady do think, and Daithí O'Connell, do think there is a way then of trying to accommodate the Unionists as well. And that's why you have the Era Nua idea of federal parliaments and so on, which no doubt will become popular again when we're trying to look at, you know, how an actual United Ireland might work in the next couple of decades. But for a lot of people, that politics isn't thought about very much. It's the idea of Brits out now is what's motivating them. And by the mid-1970s, really, there begins to be more clearly a stalemate. The insurrection is over. the war is becoming much more a low-key tit-for-tat affair. One of the British, the infamous idea of an acceptable level of violence, which was acceptable to the British state, of course, not to the people who had to live in the north. But that becomes more and more of a reality, really. Far fewer British soldiers are being killed. Most of the violence that's going on is taking place within the confines of the six counties themselves. And for people in the south and for people in Britain, they might think that's terrible, but it's not impacting them on the way that between 1971 to 72, you looked like the whole thing was going to blow up. So that creates pressures on the IRA as well and how they're going to respond. And the British come up with a way, they believe then, of squeezing the IRA further, of making them look like terrorists and criminals in terms of world opinion, of pushing them into tighter corners. And ultimately, probably thinking by the late 70s that they might be able to militarily neutralize them. I mean, privately, the British Army admit that they won't be able to defeat the IRA. While you have this idea of a United Ireland, they're going to have to face some kind of armed struggle. But they believe they can contain it to the degree that it will not be a defining feature of British politics in the way that it had been for a little while in the early 70s, I think.
This is such a dense subject. That's because obviously we live in Ireland and we're both historians, though you are a professional historian. In terms of trying to parse through it, it's very dense. And I do advise people to look in the footnotes because I will provide a lot of documentaries and links to books because there's a lot here. But broadly, the older leadership, through a combination of arrest, through a combination of just being older and living in the South and not being able to react to events, and also, you know, to be honest with you, through to some degree, the rise into their 30s and 40s of the generation, the 69ers, people like Martin McGuinness and Gerry Adams, most famously, become to dominate the Army Council and the direction of the Irish Republican Army. Their view is, at least from what I've been able to tell, a mix. They pretty much knew that the war wasn't likely to end anytime soon. I kind of think with Adams, he knew as early as the mid to late 70s that it wasn't winnable. I think that, like you said, they kind of knew there was a stalemate there. But what do you do in that circumstance? It's not very clear. You've revved up your entire base with this idea, and you've been talking about the year of victory, and it's not happened. You have Sunningdale, which maybe could have, for those who don't know, Sunningdale was basically a version of what exists now. A parliament with sharing power, with power sharing between the communities in Northern Ireland. But rather than going down that road, the question I have is, when Martin McGuinness and Adams and others, there are obviously many others, become the dominant clique, faction, whatever you want to call it, within the provisionals, certainly by the early 80s, the IRA has changed. It's gone from a much larger mass-based movement to a cell system of maybe 400 or 500. As you said, they're much better armed by that point. With something, again, we thought we could get have time to go into, but we don't, in terms of how they pay for their campaign, broadly speaking, Irish Americans and Muammar Gaddafi, and a lot of robbing of various locations. But the question I have for you here is maybe the important one. If people like Adams, and if, again, it's hard to tell what Martin McGuinness really thought about this, if they had a sense that this wasn't winnable, militarily speaking, why is it, do you think, if we can leave out the fact that there is the UDA linked with the RUC, linked with, you know, who are in turn facing the fact that, you know, people like Ian Paisley wouldn't even accept, you know, wouldn't accept Sunningdale, wouldn't accept the Anglo-Irish Treaty. We kind of have to some extent take it as a given that there's that force there which is resistant to peace. We're not going to pretend that they aren't there. Why do you think that the IRA took until the early 90s really to reach out and say, look, it's time to talk again? Because it's a very long time between the mid-70s and the early 90s to basically not even talk very much with the British.
Yeah, I suppose, again, for maybe listeners might be surprised that we could actually answer these questions quite well about earlier versions of the IRA, because those organizations kept lots of documents. We don't know really what the IRA was saying internally a lot of the time. We're very dependent on often memoirs by people who've fallen out with the IRA for some reason, or by journalistic accounts, and there's value in them. But really, you know, I can't tell you what those people thought. But I think that I think that some of the older provisional IRA leadership, like O'Connell and O'Brady, were prepared to end the war in the mid-1970s if there was some form of face-saving compromise available. I think they thought that the British might declare an intent to withdraw. I also think they genuinely were worried about a sectarian civil war, and they're in talks with loyalists and so on in 74, 75. And I think a younger element within the IRA, those who'd really emerged from the late 60s and early 70s, although Gerry Adams goes back a lot further than that, they didn't want to compromise. They did think, they didn't think the British were just going to pull out. They thought there would be a long war, but they did think they could sicken them, to use that phrase. They did think the IRA could reorganize. They weren't prepared to accept, you know, a kind of either a glorious defeat or a kind of just a step back and reorganize again. I think they thought that their time had come. They weren't going to give up. And they knew there was enough popular support to sustain some kind of armed struggle. Now, I think you've also got a dynamic that builds itself into this, that in the early 70s, a lot of local IRA units in the north were acting almost independently. There was no way that they were waiting for the Army Council to tell them what to do. And that does become a lot tighter. But at the same time, you always have local structures that are very powerful. You have a way to sustain a war, which is often, you know, I mean, if you look at how the IRA campaign is waged in parts of Fermanagh and Tyrone and so on, it's very personal. A lot of the people being killed are locals who might know each other. Killing a soldier from England is in many ways abstract. It has no local impact. But the IRA's campaign is very, you know, again, because of British policy of Ulsterization and so on, of putting locally recruited security forces in the front line, means it has its own dynamic that's actually very hard to stop, I think.
Do you want to briefly mention the issue of collusion? Again, it's a huge subject, but to kind of talk about, well, again, this, none of this is in stone yet, but there's a lot of evidence to link the UDA, the death squads run by Robin Jackson and by Billy Wright in East Tyrone, where they murder, what, 100 and something civilians who are literally just, I mean, old people in their homes in the farm at night, just murdering them, coming through the back door and murdering them. You know, serial killers who were employed by the British state. So the reason why I bring this up is perhaps one of the reasons why was the kind of the desire for revenge, for retaliation, was also an issue as to why they couldn't see peace as a possibility.
So, I mean, I think that there is a local dynamic to the conflict as well. And I think in theory, the IRA argues we're fighting against British imperialism. We only recognize the fight as a war of national liberation. It's got no sectarian aspect at all. You know, it just happens that, you know, the British are employing local people as part of their campaign against us. But in reality, the dynamics of the North mean that, you know, the majority of Protestants are never going to accept that what the IRA is doing is legitimate, whatever about the majority of the nationalist community. At the same time, at various points, but this again is very important to look at the context. There are periods in the conflict, particularly from the mid-70s to the mid-80s, where the IRA is out killing everybody by 3-1, 4-1, where there is very little loyalist paramilitary activity, and where the state forces have learned the lesson of the early 70s in terms of, you know, the effect of indiscriminate violence on nationalists and so on, in terms of radicalizing people. So the IRA, in terms of being an actor in the conflict, is very, very much ahead of the rest a lot of the time. Now, that changes by the mid-80s, and you can have Republicans would argue that that's because of British state policy to effectively allow loyalist paramilitary groups to act as proxies. Now, I think there's a great deal of truth in that, but I also think that Republicans completely underplay any agency on behalf of loyalists. I don't think the loyalists needed the British to tell them to hate Catholics, and I don't think a lot of the time they needed the British to help them. Certainly in the early 70s and mid-70s, loyalist gangs could have done what they did really without any great assistance. And I think sometimes Republicans completely deny the reality of the fact that ordinary Protestants hated them and wanted to kill them. And the British didn't need to organize, you know, a very sophisticated kind of collusive campaign around that. In other circumstances, certainly, the security forces are providing direction and providing information and so on. But I don't think it's the entire story. And I think that it can sometimes then be used as a way of trying to level up. When people say, well, the IRA killed 1,700 people, they'll say, well, the British killed 1,000 whatever. And then, you know, you've got to go through all these figures and see what they mean. And what they mean is that basically the British are responsible for every loyalist killing. And I think that that's not the way the society worked. I think there's a lot more complications in terms of the way that the loyalists operated. But certainly by the late 80s, firstly, the British state is employing shoot to kill far more directly, and IRA volunteers are being killed on a regular basis. And there also is an extensive loyalist campaign against the Catholic community more broadly. And that has an effect on Republicans, certainly, because they're under pressure to respond. And when they do try to respond, it's often disastrous. You know, events like the Shankill bomb, for example, in 1993. So, you know, how do we really know what's going on? We know that there were subterranean contacts between the Republican movement and the British for years. But I think the average IRA volunteer still believes they're fighting for a British withdrawal, at least until the early 1990s. And one problem, again, in terms of organizations like the IRA, is that what they'll say to their own membership and their own support base is often very different to what they'll say to the general public. You know, Kieran Conway, again, whose book Southside Provisional is well worth reading, was more of a perspective on the 1970s, just says, we lied whenever we thought we could get away with it, because, you know, there are things that happen that are hugely embarrassing and you don't want to admit that you did them. And it's also the case then that when you do have to compromise, you have to carry people with you. And I think the IRA leadership, or I think the Republican leadership, the way that they carried the majority of the movement with them was absolutely outstanding and astounding in some ways, because they did manage to carry the majority ultimately into a compromise, which would have been ridiculed even 5 years before. The idea that, you know, the IRA would ultimately accept some of the things they did accept would have been regarded as impossible. But they did accept them because I think they did have ultimately a strategy which revolved around politics and which, from a political point of view, has been quite successful.
Yeah, I mean, to start to finish up, again, this isn't an attempt to go through the entire history of the period, because that would be impossible in just an hour. But I think it's true to say that what we talked about there, the attrition, the reality, the just reality of the IRA having been infiltrated by British intelligence, I think it's pretty clear that it was very difficult, unless you were organizing something out of South Armagh, to get very much of anything done by the early 90s, which is why the truck bombs that happened in London and in Manchester in 96, 97 came from South Armagh, because it was the only area they thought was not infiltrated, which I don't think it was, actually. Anyway, the point is, peace follows. Adams's charisma and Adams's ability, really, as a politician, has to be recognized. His ability to draw, you were talking about, it's astounding what they're able to get most of the IRA to agree to. Adams has to be given his flowers to some degree for doing that. His ability, almost like a cult leader, to get them to follow down a road which they, as you said, never would have accepted before, is amazing. I mean, it's certainly not something that even Michael Collins or anyone else was able to do back in the day, because 3/4 of the IRA went out against the treaty back in 1922. Anyway, the point is, having that achieved that, and having the conflict eventually been come to a compromise, we have to look at the tail of the tape. So of the original goals of the IRA, of the provisional movement, there is no British withdrawal, though there is, however, demilitarization. The police obviously are restructured from the RUC into the PSNI, the Police Service of Northern Ireland. There's still a majority of Protestants within the PSNI now, and there is still questions regularly placed by Republicans as to why certain loyalist paramilitary groups still have weapons, are still allowed to function the way they are. A member of the UVF, I think, has just been arrested in Belfast. Irvin, I think it's Winky Irvin. It's a very strange name. They often have strange names. But yeah, so there's questions of that. But for the most part, peace has held for most of the last 30 years. How, as a historian, as somebody who without putting words in your mouth, would sit on the left of the spectrum. I don't think it's too much to suggest that, is it, Brian? That you might sit on the left of the political perspective?
No, it's not too much to suggest it.
Okay, so how would you look at the armed campaign and the IRA, the provisional IRA? Is there anything from your perspective that can be learned from it? Because again, without going, because so much of it was, I don't want to use the word apolitical, but the IRA, the provisionals, today would like to present themselves would like to present itself as social democratic. I think that's fair. Whether they are or not is another question for another podcast. But do you think there is anything to be learned from what they did, or what they did wrong? Is there anything basically to be learned from that experience? If you're a left-wing person, again, they were calling themselves socialists. Whether you believe that or not, again, we can talk about. But is there anything to be learned from them on any level about what they did and what they achieved or what they failed to do?
Well, I think they were a genuinely popular movement that emerged, in reaction to discrimination and to repression. And I also think it was legitimate to defend their communities and also to defend themselves against the power of the British state. And I think, I suppose, that there's a lot of other things you've raised in your kind of preamble there. I mean, I think the jury is massively out on the whole theory that the movement was so infiltrated that there was really no other road. I think that's a political judgment by a lot of people who can't accept Sinn Féin's success. So they have to argue, well, really, it all came to an end because they were defeated. If they were defeated, they'd have surrendered and there wouldn't have been any compromises at all. I think it's a much more complicated story than that. And the bombings that they carried out were still, I don't think the British state's just allowing those things to happen. I think that the whole question of infiltration and so on is still going to be something we'll be talking about a lot longer. Again, I don't think it's a story of a cult. I think that it's a political movement with a lot of diverse tendencies that Adams and McGuinness and a lot of other people were able to move in a particular direction because they politically convinced them that there would be successes. Now, some of that, I think, was illusory. I mean, in the early 2000s, Gerry Adams was talking about a united Ireland by 2016. That was never going to happen. But at the same time, young Republicans now can say, well, it looks like there might be a united Ireland. Now, I think that's for a whole range of reasons. But nevertheless, you can argue that something, there is some connection to the success of the Republican movement in bringing that about. So, I mean, I think that they are a working class movement. They are a movement that has huge experience in community organizing that emerged from communities that were resisting oppression. In terms of the armed struggle, it's not a moral issue for me in many ways because, there are people who are acclaimed as statesmen all over the world who are responsible for far greater acts of violence than the IRA was. But ultimately, at the end of the day, I think that it was hugely politically counterproductive, certainly after the early 70s, that they couldn't hope to win the level of support that was necessary in the South, for example. The South was never going to buy into the armed struggle in the way it was waged. And also then I think the reality was that it becomes self-sustaining after a while, that it's not really being fought for the greater picture of British withdrawal, but it's being fought by because you think you have to continue to do it. And there's reasons that you continue to wage that war. I mean, again, another, just when people are listening to all this, there's a very good book by Ian Cobain, Anatomy of a Killing, which is based around the late 70s. And that kind of shows you the very different ways in which the armed struggle had developed by that period. And also what a hugely depressing time that was in the history of Ireland. So, I mean, I think that there's a lot of unanswered questions and a lot of things that are going to be argued about for generations to come because you've got a very divided society which became more divided as a result of the conflict. And I'm not in a position to sit in judgment on anybody who did anything in reaction to the conditions they grew up in that period. But I do think we should examine everything that happened quite closely and not fall into the kind of sloganeering that you get when these things are discussed. I mean, look at the day-to-day reality of what went on over 30 years and then make up your own mind.
And equally, just as a last word, I think to look at the Northern Ireland of 1966 and to look at the Northern Ireland of 2016 before the Brexit referendum, with all of its problems, it is a significantly changed society. And it is very much, nobody has the answer as to whether that would have been possible if there had not been the troubles, the civil conflict, the, you know, we don't know, obviously, there's no way of knowing. But given the, you know, intransigence, the violence that was there within the UVF, Paisley, the RUC, the B specials, the later on, you know, attempts, I don't know. And it is an open question and will probably always be an open question as to how that was, whether that was possible, in the same way that, unfortunately, we have our, much of our, of the history of, or the discussion of 1916 circles around, was it a necessary event? And again, there is no answer. And anyone who, again, who claims to have an answer is acting in bad faith in my mind, or is just not, doesn't know enough about how complicated a subject it is. But yeah, ultimately, it's up to you guys who are listening to this to check the footnotes. You'll find a lot of information there to make up your own mind. But certainly comparing them to the other groups we've talked about in this season, they were able at the very last moment to do a deal and achieve some of their goals, if not the majority of their goals. And as a political movement, reorganized as Sinn Féin, which today, you know yourself, Brian, is the most popular political party on this island. Whether people like that or not, it is the reality. And ultimately, maybe that is the lasting achievement of the provisional split and the provisional IRA, was the current, you know, almost dominance of Irish politics of Sinn Féin.
Yeah, I mean, again, I think that the success of Sinn Féin is the success of a movement that gave up armed struggle and very successfully then embraced a form of campaigning politics different sides of the border. And that really, that success would not have been possible while the armed struggle was still taking place. I think that is the irony. You know, politically, Sinn Féin cannot distance themselves from the IRA's armed struggle to any great extent. But in reality, I think they know that you would not have overtaken the SDLP and not become the force that they've become if there was an armed struggle still going on. So I think that is something to consider when you think about whether it was justified or not. On the other hand, of course, the conditions that gave rise to that armed struggle in the early 1970s are quite clearly not present today. And we're talking about a very, very different type of society.
And on that note, we're going to leave it. There is one more episode of the season to go where we kind of try and parse through the various groups and come up with some type of opinion about armed, you know, physical force movements versus moral force. But that's going to be us. I'd like to thank Dr. Brian Handley for providing his expertise and his time, and ignoring all my inability to control technology. If you'd like to, I think you're on Twitter, aren't you, Brian?
I am not.
You're not. Is there any way to learn, to get hold of something that's not an academic piece on you? Do you, is there anywhere that you could find some of your published work?
There is a certain amount of stuff online, I think, but I'm not. I'm not on any of the social media platforms.
In other words, Google Brian Handley, and
you'll find something.
You'll find something. Google will help you there. And certainly get hold of his excellent book on the history of the official IRA to learn another history within that, the creation of the Workers' Party. But on that note, we're going to go. Thanks very much for listening, and we'll be back in about 2 weeks for one last episode. Bye-bye.